Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Mike Miles is done with Dallas. After 3 years as superintendent of the city's largest school district, marked by big promises of change and improvement, numerous run-ins with board members over his management philosophies and staffing and salary decisions, Miles announced yesterday he was ready to return home to Colorado Springs. That's disappointing news to some who believed his ideas for reforming Dallas schools would work if he could get support for them, and welcome news to others who point to widening gaps between statewide standardized test scores and those of students within the district. Mike Miles is with us now to talk about his years as DISD superintendent and the state of the district he is leaving behind. Mike, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Happy to be here today.
I understand your eagerness to return to living with your family. They've been back in Colorado for a couple of years now. That kind of separation is tough. What are the job-related reasons for your departure from DISD?
Well, you know, you have to look at the timing. You have to look at the foundation that we've laid and whether or not we're making great progress, which we are, and whether it's beginning of the year, end of year. So I think over the last 3 years, we've laid a great foundation, and I can get into some of that if you want. But the district is poised to move forward in the future, and we're right at that point. And so I think the timing was right for me to go.
If that's the case, if you're poised to move forward, why not stay and bring that to fruition?
Well, you know, again, there's other considerations. There's my family is one of the biggest things. And the question is how much further we can go under the direction of my leadership team.
You took this job knowing that the tenure had been pretty short for lots of other superintendents in recent memory. When you moved in, you said, I bought a house. I want to live there till I die. I mean, people make different decisions about real estate all the time. But did you, in fact, take the job expecting that it might just be a couple of years?
No. I mean, my family moved down here. That was a huge decision. We bought a house. My son and my wife were here. And so, no, we were coming down here to for the long haul.
What made you want to take the job in the first place?
You know, I'm a public servant. If you look at my careers, this is my third career. My first career was an Army officer. My second career was as a U.S. diplomat. And my third as an educator. And all of those are about public service. And this was an opportunity to impact more kids and make a difference in the lives of a lot of people.
So you had this career, the second career in diplomacy. There are people who have argued that the thing that really made it hard for you to do everything you wanted to do was that you struggled with explaining what you wanted to do to people in such a way that it got everybody on board with your plans.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at the record. In 3 years, this district has been able to do more reform-minded, transformative things than any other district in the United States. We passed and implemented the most rigorous pay-for-performance system for teachers in the United States. We didn't have a strike. We didn't have, I know it's illegal to strike, but we didn't have protests, you know, the same degree. Just think about the things that happen across the country. We passed the most important principal evaluation system in the nation. We're now in our fourth, we're going to start our fourth year of that. We increased the number of schools of choice, early childhood initiatives. We started the ACE plan. We grew the fund balance. So how could one administrative team do all those things without board support, without community support? I mean, I think sometimes we forget that while there are, yes, those things that people like to point out and dramatize, in the end of the day, the community, the board, and the admin team work together to pass the most rigorous reform elements you've seen in the country with actually relatively little noise. We didn't have a Washington, D.C., you know, blow up and loud, you know, publicity around teacher eval. And ours is more rigorous than theirs or anywhere else. So, yes, there are those dramatic things you can point to. But in the end of the day, the record reflects moving a whole system and getting people on board with some of the most rigorous reform elements in the country.
When you accepted the position here, how did you go about assessing what the greatest challenges were for the Dallas Independent School District specifically?
Well, you know, there's a lot of data you can look at, but I like to be on the ground. In the end of the day, the challenge is going to be in the classroom, right? The victory is there. The quality of the teachers, the instruction, the leadership team in the schools, and the expectations. So the way I assessed it was by walking around, going to the schools. I may have told you the story where before I was interviewed, I visited several schools in Dallas incognito. I said I was a parent. I was thinking about relocating to Dallas. And could I just walk around the schools? All of that was true. I had a fifth grader at the time. And so I went to several schools and checked out, you know, the quality of instruction, how welcoming the environment was, the quality of the teaching, et cetera. And that's how I got to assess. And I did that my first couple months. I went to, I don't know, 20 schools at least to see what was going on.
Is it accurate to say that the core of your concerns with what wasn't working in DISD was really about campus-level administration and classroom teachers?
I think the core is what the foundation of any school district rests on, and that is the capacity and the leadership. So we have great teachers, but the question is, how strong is the quality of that instruction for 10,400 teachers in 222 schools? And what about the campus leadership team? We have a profession built on management versus leadership and instructional leadership. And that's not a diss to anybody. That's just how our profession has been. So to assess it, you have to look at those sorts of things. And then that third element is also foundational, and that is, what is the level of expectation? Expectations for students, expectations for staff. And those are the things you look at when you assess a school or district.
What's the difference between management and leadership?
So management keeps the schedule running on time. Leadership is about taking people where they would not otherwise go themselves. It's about growth. It's about innovation. It's about challenge. It's about breaking the status quo. Management is about keeping the status quo, being compliant. And we want to err on commitment versus compliance. And that's always the struggle, right? Because people want you to be compliant. They want you to color within the lines. And that's a good manager. But leadership is something altogether different. And if you want to change an organization, transform it, you have to have leadership, not just management.
So you've talked about some of the changes that you put in place to do a better job evaluating and compensating people for really good performances and maybe calling them to task for performances that weren't working. The one thing we haven't seen that everybody was hoping for, including you, was a substantive rise in test scores. In fact, in like 8 or 9 out of 11 different benchmarks for students between 3rd and 8th grade, we have lost ground as compared with other parts of the state and the country.
Well, no, that's not accurate, first of all.
Explain.
So if you look at the growth of our kids, you know, when you look at data, and I'm very familiar with data of all sorts, and I know you can pick and choose different pieces of data. One of the things that the state needs and what we have in Dallas is a growth metric. We call it CEI, Classroom Effectiveness Index, or SEI, School Effectiveness Index. And that means this is where a kid started, this is how much he grew. There is one group that's doing it in the state, and that's ERG Analytics. That's an independent company, nonprofit, that's doing this sort of work, comparing districts relative to other districts in the state, relative to the poverty level, and how much did these districts grow academically. And Dallas has grown more than any other large district that's challenged by poverty. And the growth has been, they called it last year, miraculous. And so you have to really look at what you're talking about. If you compare us to Houston, for example, we grew much more than Houston just on straight what we call status proficiency rating. So the comparisons have to be much more nuanced. People have to understand what changed about the assessments. Look at the accountability system, for example, from a year ago. The state put almost doubled, I think, the number of schools that we call improvement required that didn't meet state accountability because they raised the rigor. Well, so if Dallas has more schools that are improvement required, the question is, compared to what? Compared to the state? Because if you raise the rigor and you have more schools that didn't meet it, are you worse off or are you the same or are you better off? It's hard to tell unless you compare to other districts of similar size and similar poverty rates.
All right, let's talk about the poverty in Dallas. A significant percentage of DISD students could be considered at risk for reasons of poverty, for English language acquisition, for race. Is there something different about the challenges of being poor in Dallas from being poor in Houston or Denver or New York City?
No. Every district has its own differences with regard to the challenges that students face. And they have different conditions. So you do have to be a little bit careful. However, the challenges of poverty do exist everywhere. And kids who are challenged by poverty in Denver and Houston and New York are not that much dissimilar than the kids who are challenged by poverty in Dallas. So the goal is to move those kids are kids who are challenged by poverty, even under those conditions. And that's where the expectations comes in. So it's a fine balance. You want to be sensitive and you want to understand that kids who come from poverty have more challenges. At the same time, you don't want to listen to the faction that says because they are challenged by poverty, they can't achieve at the same levels. That's two different mindsets.
And yet, of course, when we're talking about the challenges of poverty and you say, you know, test scores when comparing other poor students, we're making a lot of ground up. It sounds like you're maybe using poverty as an explanation for why students here continue to struggle and then also saying, but that can't be the reason that they're struggling or the reason that we let them struggle.
Yeah. So I think it's not an either or, right? I think when you think about how to move an organization and how to inspire teachers, you have to give them credit for the growth that kids get. If a kid is 3 years behind the bar, let's say seventh grade reading or seventh grade math, and they're 3 years behind and that teacher or the system moves them 2 years in 1 year's time, that to the average person out there is going to look like a failure, right? Like they did not become proficient, Mr. Miles, so therefore you failed. Well, and I'm saying, yes, and let's give credit, though, to those teachers, to those kids that grew them 2 years. That's excellent teaching. Yes, the kid didn't pass, but that's excellent teaching. How can we not look at both pieces of data? Because in the end, you're right. I'm the one who says our ACT scores have to be higher. That's a static metric, that kids have to be college and career ready. At the same time, while we're building this system that's a high-performance culture, you have to give credit to growth. You have to have both metrics, growth and proficiency level. And by the way, you know, 3 years to change a system, really, I've said it's not really long enough to see the results when you change a whole system to build a new foundation.
We're speaking this hour with Mike Miles, who worked for nearly 3 years as superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District. He announced yesterday he would be resigning from the position. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mike Miles, who worked for nearly 3 years as superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District and announced yesterday that he would be resigning from the position. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. All right, let's talk about staffing decisions, hiring decisions at the top level. This is a place where you've come in for a great deal of criticism. A lot of people felt that you paid too much to people in these positions. There were accusations that you were making decisions about hiring that were outside of district policies and sort of skirted protocol. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I've been accused of coloring outside the lines, and you know, actually, I'm okay with that.
Well, there's coloring outside the lines and there's breaking the rules.
Well, that's right. I didn't break any rules. So let's take, for example, hiring decisions. We've hired some great talent in this district. And I can go through names when you think about people like Alan Cohen, Lindsay Koshet, Gil Garza, Willie... in human capital management or in operations. Those sorts of folks are just phenomenal. And then if you look at my cabinet, our chiefs. Our chiefs are first rate. They've been here for 2 years. They're very stable group, very professional group, very sought after group of people. And so let's talk about their salaries. If you look at the market study that was done independently, not our own people doing the study, we are below the median in every chief position, every single one, the salaries for those chiefs. So, I mean, I know people pounce on one salary or this salary or that salary, and that then becomes the rule for the whole administration. And that's simply not true. I think you got to look at the facts.
All right, I want to throw out one more name, Tanya Sadler Grayson, human resources specialist with the district. There is evidence that she lied about criminal history on application forms. An internal investigation found other issues as well. Why keep her on staff in a very prominent position?
You know, I don't want to spend too much time talking about Tanya.
This is just one question.
Yeah, I'm going to answer it. What the city and media are doing to Tanya, it's not right. I'm on the record as saying that. It's not right. As a superintendent, I don't actually get into the personalities of these decisions that, yes, I know them as people, and I work with them a little bit, but really I work my chiefs really closely. But I have to look at the whole system, and I have to look at how we handle personnel decisions. And the frustrating thing is I'm not sure people are asking the right questions. So here's the questions that might be asked. Should we as a district hire anybody for any reason in the past where they have a misdemeanor at any level? I mean, yes or no. Now, the more thoughtful people will say, well, it's not just a yes or no. The more thoughtful people will probably say, well, it depends on how long ago it was. It depends on what it is. And it depends on the level of that person. So should you ever hire a superintendent who's had a misdemeanor? Ever? No matter if it was 50 years ago, 30 years ago, for whatever reason. And maybe the answer for the superintendent is no, we'll never hire a superintendent. Okay, that's probably fair. I don't know. That seems a little harsh to me. If it was, you know, the superintendent when he was 18 threw a water balloon on somebody's head from the fourth floor of a building and got caught and got written up for public disturbance of some sort. By the way, I didn't do that. But
would you have felt obligated to disclose it if that had happened?
Yes.
For some people, that's okay, the crux of the issue.
All right, so then let's go to that. Let's ask that question. Should we ever hire anybody who doesn't disclose, whether they knew it or not, whether they knew it, no, let's say they lie about it, on their application, a misdemeanor from their youth. So that's a question that should be asked, right? And we can fall out on different sides of that question, but let's ask it. And maybe it would help if you knew that 100 times this year, 100 at least, this year, people have not disclosed on their application some misdemeanor or charge, in some cases felony, and we have made good decisions or at least reviewed that decision to see whether or not we should still keep them on. And in 2/3 of the cases, we have. So is that wrong? Should Dallas ISD rethink its policy? So I'd ask people to ask those sorts of questions. And then, you know, just from a human standpoint about continuous improvement and about making sure that we are a district, we don't have to be the place of second chances. But you know what? We know that people need to grow. And when you do something when you're 19, and we're going to hold that against you for the rest of your life, and then we're going to make you out to be a criminal, I hope people who have kids, I have two. I have one that's 23, one that's 22, and I've got a boy who's going to be 14 tomorrow, a little boy who's going to be 14 tomorrow. You know, I don't think they did anything like that, but I can imagine them having done some prank that they didn't get caught for, and if they had, they'd have some misdemeanor on their file. And, you know, I hope 30 years later nobody says something about them and then tries to ruin their life as a result.
Okay, let's switch gears here. I want to talk a little bit about graduation rates. Progress has been made there. You came in saying 90% graduation rate, high school graduation rate by 2020.
That's correct.
Do you think it's still possible?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's of all the metrics, that's the one that's the easiest to hit. We went from 81 in 2012 to 86% graduation rate. So we're only 4 points away. But you've also heard me say that the graduation rate has to be accompanied by a college-ready rate. Just raising the graduation rate is not rigorous enough. Yes, kids need to graduate first, so that's a good thing. And yes, we should be applauding that, and I hope people do. But it's not enough. The college-ready rate is what you want, because you could raise the graduation rate by just lowering standards. So, for example, when the state just passed this graduation committee law that allows students to fail one or two end-of-course exams, and then the district is allowed to have these graduation committees that will look at other ways for kids to pass and walk across the stage or graduate anyway, we said in the district that we were going to continue to be rigorous in those graduation committees. We're not just going to have kids walk across the stage by doing some small essay or some, you know, something pretty routine in order to pass. And people got mad at me and the staff a little bit for that decision, because they could have walked in May and we didn't let them. We said, no, you have to go through this graduation committee, and the criteria are going to be rigorous. You still have to you have to demonstrate that you've learned and you are college or career ready. And so we're not going to try to inflate our graduation rate that way. We could have easily gained 1 or 2 points on our graduation rate that way, but we're not doing it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mary in Plano. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm wondering, Mike, how you determine whether or not a teacher is effective or not, whether or not you use simply star scores, or you said that you have improved the principal observation plan. And I am a teacher, and I sometimes get frustrated at the stress that is put on star scores and not so much on the personal connections that the teacher makes with the students. So how do you evaluate teachers?
Mm-hmm. So those are all the right questions. Thank you for asking. We look at teachers fairly comprehensively. And so for most teachers, their evaluation is based on three big things. One is student achievement results. Another is the performance in the classroom based on observations. And then the third is student surveys. So student, if they have a great relationship with the student, that's going to be reflected in the survey. If they're engaging the kids, if they're challenging the kid, that's going to be reflected from the student, the client's perspective. And that's worth 15 points. The student achievement is worth 35 points, and that's based on multiple measures. So what I said earlier about status, which is whether the kid is proficient or not, that's one way of looking at the scores and whether or not the teacher got most of their kids proficient. But another way is whether or not the kids grew relative to all the other kids in Dallas ISD. That's called a value-added metric. We call that CEI, Classroom Effectiveness Index. And then there's yet a third way that we look at teachers, and that is we group kids in academic peer groups, four different bins of academic peers, and the teacher's job is to get that kid over the average for that bin. So Johnny is not competing with Sally, who always gets straight A's. He's competing with all the other kids in his academic peer across the district. So, and by the way, we give the teacher the best of the three. So maybe the city should, or the state should give the district the best of the three metrics, a value-added metric, a peer group metric, and a status metric. And that's what we were arguing about earlier, or discussing earlier, one of the first questions.
We have an email here from Carrie who asks, do you believe personal teaching experience might be necessary in order to effectively identify with and manage a school district, especially one as large and complex as DISD?
No, but it helps. I think if you really want to design systems that impact teachers, it helps if you have that understanding of what it really means and takes to be a teacher. I've been a teacher, but I can imagine successful superintendents. It's not just about the classroom experience. It's also about running a big operation. There's that management side. But the leadership side will suffer a little bit, because leadership is also about inspiring and taking people to a place they would not otherwise go. And, teachers want to see people walk the talk, right? They want to see that you know what they're feeling, you know what it's about. And so it doesn't mean you can't do it. And there's been a lot of successful superintendents who've not been teachers, but I think it certainly would help.
You didn't say a whole lot about the proposal for making DISD a home rule charter when this was all being talked about last year. Now that you are no longer in the employ of the district, tell us what you think.
I'm not sure this is the time for reflection on that question. I will tell you this. That question of board governance and how boards operate and how they operate superintendents and how superintendents work with boards, I think is an important question. And I think that there has to be a lot more thoughtful conversations about it before the city's done.
Tell us about, how would you characterize your relationship with the board of the Dallas Independent School District?
Let me start by saying, if you look at the last 3 years, we had an effectiveness relationship to get a lot done. And that's good for kids. And that's actually what you would expect, right? And so overall, I would say it was effective. It was effective to get the job done for kids. I think superintendents and boards always have to work on that relationship. And I think there are systemic issues. And if people can take the personalities out, I mean, often that's where people want to go, right? They like the drama, the personalities, and those sorts of things. I like to look at systems. So, for example, it's a hard job being a board member, because you're being pulled towards constituent services all the time. And you're being pulled by the people who elect you to office to advocate for your part of the district. Sometimes that means your interests are going to be in direct opposition to one other part of the district. South Dallas is not like Southeast Dallas, and Southeast Dallas is not like West Dallas, and West Dallas is not like Northeast Dallas, et cetera. And so if you're purely advocating for that group of constituents and you don't look at the 160,000 kids, it's hard to move together in some transformative way.
So is there an argument to be made for taking those 160,000 students, 20-odd thousand employees, a little over half of whom are teachers, and breaking the district up into more manageable pieces that might serve particular regions of the community that might have very different needs, as you say, from neighborhoods across town?
You know, I don't know if that's a solution. I worry about that as a solution because I worry that some parts of town may get more attention and resources than another.
But that's already happening, right?
Well, yes and no. For example, the ACE plan. This is a plan where seven schools are getting some of our most distinguished teachers and our most distinguished leadership teams, voluntary, of course, and more resources. And those schools drew from teachers and leaders from across the district. So everybody contributed to those schools, even though the schools are concentrated in the South. So that's a great way of, yes, redistributing some of the quality of the teachers and redistributing some of the resources to the most needy parts of town. That's controversial, right? And if I was a trustee, I might be angry about that if I had to, if I was losing people and not receiving any. But hopefully, I mean, I think our trustees are overall good with the program. So that would not be possible in a district if you split up the district into, you know, nine pieces, seven pieces, or five pieces.
We're speaking this hour with Mike Miles, who worked as Dallas Independent School District Superintendent for nearly 3 years and announced yesterday he would resign from the position. Excuse me. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mike Miles, who announced yesterday he is resigning his position as superintendent of Dallas Independent Schools. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You're leaving before the vote on the bond package that would have done a lot of renovations and built new campuses. How likely is that to pass if you're not here to push for it?
Yeah, so there hasn't been a vote to go for that yet, and that's upcoming. Happy that we passed this comprehensive, we call it the bridge plan, interim bridge plan, $143 million. That got passed a couple months ago. And I think it has a strong chance of passing if the community understands that we're all invested in our kids, that all of us, you know, for the good of the city in the future, whether we have kids in school or not, need to have buildings that are functional, that are tied to the to a year 2020 environment versus, you know, the 1960 buildings that we have, and that all kids deserve those sorts of facilities. And we're way behind in our deferred maintenance needs. This has been growing over the last couple decades. And so hopefully the city will realize that they have to play that role.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Becky in Rowlett. Hi, Becky.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm left the district and going to another district to teach in the fall, and I have a couple of questions based on some things that Mr. Miles has said today. one of which is this obvious dichotomy that he's drawn between leadership versus management, data, measuring data versus observing relationships and those types of things. And I'm concerned because as a teacher in the district, one of my things that I experienced there was that the mandates that were required of me, a longtime teacher, to do things that were mandated from the administrative level, mandated down through my principal, through to me, to teach in particular ways, to use verbs in particular ways, to question in particular ways that someone thought was the proper way versus what I knew to be the proper way and effective way of teaching, makes me wonder why Mr. Miles thinks that his establishment in the district was more of a leadership role as opposed to a management role. Because by your own definition, I see that some of the problems were that it was a mandated management style.
What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think what she brings up is this notion of to what degree do we have autonomy and how do you get those messages consistent? So, for example, it comes as a surprise to some people outside the system that we had a great deal of autonomy, and I actually didn't mandate a lot. I get, you know, you hear that out there that Mr. Miles has dictated lesson plans or Mr. Miles has dictated this strategy. We have dictated four things in the schools. One is, and I'm sure the person on the line can name those four things. One is lesson objective. We don't say what it has to be tied to the state standards. So what is it that you're going to teach or the kids are supposed to learn today? Number two is what we call a demonstration of learning. How will you know? We don't say what you have to teach. How will you know? Number three, the use of engagement strategies, multiple response strategies, but it doesn't have to be ours. It can be anybody's. Multiple. And number four is whatever you say you're going to teach, you got to be teaching something related to that. It's called purposeful aligned instruction. That's it. If how you want to teach, which resources you want to use, there's only one program, only one, that has been dictated by my office, and that is Reasoning Mind at second, third, and fourth grade. That's it. Actually, second and third grade. Fourth is voluntary. Any other program, any textbook, we buy textbook, but they can use them if they want. They don't have to use them if they don't want. They can use the internet. They don't have to use it. I mean, what you want to teach and how you teach it, that's up to you. But those lesson objectives and demonstrations of learning, those are good foundational instructional practices aligned to what we call curriculum alignment. That is the bread and butter of alignment. And that's it. So, you know, I hear all these other things like, well, you said we have to use the verbs. I don't never said anything like that. And I'm sure my senior team hasn't. Now, has there been filters and people do what they want? You know, principals and executive directors put some guidance in. We've had a lot of training around what we call coaching, and EDs and principals should be coaches rather than directors or inspectors, and that's an ongoing process.
If your perspective on this and Becky's are really different and she felt micromanaged when working for the district, does that speak to some kind of flaw in the chain of command somehow?
Yes. And it's not anything that people should, you know, see as so unusual. It's a big organization. We're working on making sure that whatever messages that I have doesn't get distorted. And we're working on more and more autonomy. Becky would be happy to know that we have implemented levels of autonomy so that it's outlined very specifically what is autonomous and what's not for schools. So a principal can no longer say, well, that Mr. Miles said we have to do lesson plans. Well, it's written in writing what is autonomous, and that's an autonomous decision by the principal.
We have an email here from Pam who wants to know, was the revelation about the sweet deal offered by to the new Highland Park superintendent, certainly facing less of a challenge than you did, a last straw?
No, I mean, that's a great question. That's kind of humorous, too. Look, I mean, everybody has to think about in my line, I think there's no such thing as an unfair trade, right? In other words, if you agree to work for this amount of money, you're agreeing to work for that amount of money, you must find value in that. And it's not just a salary, of course. I mean, all of us want to be valued and paid what the position is worth. But at the same time, there's other value that you get out of a position. I just talked to my son in L.A. this a week ago. He got a raise. It's at the end of his first year of real work after college, and he got a raise. But I also told him, look, you know, it's great that you got a raise, but you got to figure out you're getting value right now, Nick, because you are building your resume. The company is training you, giving you skills. And so that is worth something too. And so you have to figure that it's not just your salary, it's these other things. And so I've had a great opportunity. I've learned a lot. I've grown. I've grown in my own leadership. And that's value too.
What's the most important thing you've learned that would equate with a $300,000 paycheck every year?
The most important thing I've learned?
Working here.
You know, when you look at, when you lead a large scale organization, you get to see and learn how systemic things either move an organization forward or hurt an organization. You get to see really what it means. When I say compliance, culture, what does that look like? What does that mean? And how do you move it? What are the obstacles that brings versus a high-performance culture? What does it really take to innovate? What does that mean? And what does status quo actually look like on the ground? I mean, it's easy to throw those terms out.
Excuse me for interrupting. Dallas a compliance culture? Dallas Independent School District a compliance culture versus a high performing culture?
When I got here, it was a compliance culture, and it's less so today than it was then. We are not a high performance culture yet, but we are moving in that direction. And high performance culture means a lot of different things, but you know, some of the things it means is that people take the initiative, that people grow the leadership capacity, that people have high support and high accountability, not one or the other. You can't just have support and professional development. You also have to have accountability. Neither can you have just accountability. You have to have high support. It's commitment versus compliance. Those are the things. It's higher expectations. So those are the things of a high-performance culture versus a compliance culture.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Danae on the line in Dallas. Hi, Danae.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for answering my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to call, and I think Mr. Miles might remember me. I'm Danae Gutierrez.
Yes, I do remember you. Hi, thank you.
I just wanted to say thank you for everything you've done for the district. You know, being part of all the committees and groups that I am in the district, I know that parents like the changes that are happening in our district. I see it in our schools. I'm there all the time, and I'm very sad to see you go. Yesterday, I was almost crying. I'm like, no, why is he leaving? I had to call my trustee and be like, why? But I want to wish you well, and I just hope that our trustees find somebody that can continue the good work that you were doing, and that hopefully they'll learn to work as a team, and that they realize that they are our leadership and that they need to act like adults.
Well, thank you, Danae. That's very nice of you. It points out, though, you, but there many other parents really are the variable that will make the district move forward faster. For example, we had our parent survey results about 3 weeks ago returned, and belief in the direction of the district went from 70% to 81% in just 1 year. And so that's good, and that's because of people like you, Danae, and others who really want to be engaged in the school system and want to see good things for our kids.
Is there anything, Mike, that you thought would happen over the past 3 years or that you would have made significant progress toward that hasn't happened?
You know, I knew that this was going to be a long game, right? This is not, there's no flip the switch, that's what I call it, no flip the switch thing you can do. I know that you have to build the foundation first. You know, I said when I got here that there, you know, it would be tough. And, you know, one of the reasons why I was brought here was to change the district, but also to make the tough decisions that few others would be prepared to make. That's the nature of leadership in a transformative era in an organization that was that was very, you know, compliant, driven, or in some ways dysfunctional. And so I'm happy that we've moved at the pace we moved. I'm happy at the foundation that we set. And it has been about the right pace that I can see.
If an old friend called you and said, hey, I'm one of the candidates for the job that you just vacated, would you say, take it without reservations? Would you say, run the other direction? What advice would you give?
You know, hope springs eternal with everybody, right? And so I think my job is to try to give people hope rather than, you know, emphasize their worst fears. And that's a lesson for myself too, right? It's better to bring people to their best hopes rather than focus on their worst fears. So the best hope that I would tell this person is, look, there's an incredible community that wants the school system to be better. You have a lot of interested stakeholders. I mean, you know, I better not go down a list of names, but, you know, Todd Williams and Commit, the mayor, Mayor Rawlings, Dale Petrosky from the chamber. You've got a whole bunch of community people who are interested in the success of Dallas ISD. So I would tell that's a huge plus, right? So second, we've set a great foundation. So you can come in here. You don't have to break the china. We've already done that. But every superintendent wants to make changes. You don't have you can move at a moderate pace. Third, we really do have a bunch of great kids. I'm not just saying that. I've walked around in schools all the time, but I've also walked around schools in lots of different parts of the country. And I won't mention any other district across the country, but I'm telling you, our kids are good kids, and they will rise to the level of expectation. So if you're looking for a district where kids are ripe to have those expectations raised, you know, come to Dallas. And then finally, we've grown the capacity of our teachers and principals. And we're not there yet, okay? We've got a ways to go. But if you want to build on that foundation, if you really want a staff that's committed, they're there. That commitment is there. We have to grow in our capacity a little bit, our skill set. But we got a staff and a group of principals who are committed to kids in Dallas.
Mike Miles worked for nearly 3 years as superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District. He announced yesterday that he would resign from the post. Mike, thank you so much for making time for us.
It's great to be here.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.